Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
It's a complete vindication of Donald Trump's first term. As you know, there was a lot of controversy about the first term with regard to COVID and with regard to January 6th. But I think the winning of the Electoral College with winning the popular vote of 73 million votes is a complete vindication and revalidation of President Trump's mandate to continue the agenda that he had when he was the 45th president of the United States.
Former President Donald Trump defeats incumbent Vice President Kamala Harris in Tuesday's presidential contest.
Well, I sit here and I take that mantle to educate our community and say, hey, you know, there's also power when we get our people at the table, when we get our people to talk about, you know, this is what's important to us. And because that's the whole essence of politics, right? And being a leader in that space, making sure that you're fighting for the voices.
Huldah Hillesley becomes the only person born in Kenya to win election to the State House of Representatives in Minnesota.
The behavior and conduct of parliament, especially in this term, has been very suspect in so many ways. We have noted that parliament is no longer led by arguments as it's supposed to be, but there are a lot of underhand activities that are going on.
And a scuffle between two Ugandan lawmakers is generating debate. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former President Donald Trump defeated incumbent Vice President Kamala Harris in Tuesday's presidential contest. Trump won both the Electoral College and the popular vote in what analysts say was a stunning political comeback. The former president is now scheduled to be sworn in on January 20 as the 47th president. For analysis, I read Joseph Slavik. He is the founder of Scribe Strategies and Advisors, which now counts business, government, and nonprofit clients on four continents. He had served at the White House during the first Bush administration as a policy analyst in the Office of Policy Development and as liaison with the Office of Cabinet Affairs and the Office of Legislative Affairs.
Listen, it's a complete vindication of Donald Trump's first term. As you know, there was a lot of controversy about the first term with regard to COVID and with regard to January 6th. But I think the winning of the Electoral College of 310 or 315 electoral votes, winning the popular vote of 73 million votes versus 67 million votes for Kamala Harris, is a complete vindication and revalidation of President Trump's mandate to continue the agenda that he had when he was the 45th president of the United States.
So, Joe, what do you think were his major key points that led to this victory?
So that's a good question, Peter. The bottom line, I think it was very simple. I think the main underlying tone was the economy. You know, the question that Donald Trump asked everyone is, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? That was the very same question that Ronald Reagan used when he ran against Jimmy Carter. And I think what happened was the pro-U.S. position in terms of economic revitalization is the key. And if you look at the vote, Kamala Harris, if you look at in this election, every precinct that Joe Biden ran in, Kamala Harris underperformed Joe Biden. And if you look at the last time President Trump ran, he overperformed in each precinct. So I think the simple message was, are you economically better off today? And I think that message resonated with a lot of independent voters and a lot of members who are members of the union. And I think they were willing to give President Trump a second chance to make America great again.
Why do you think a lot of analysts missed this that you were talking about? Because a lot of analysts were predicting something totally different, and they were shocked on election night.
Peter, that's a very good point. You know, my firm, Scribe Strategies, we put a report together for many of our clients giving our assessment or analysis of President Trump's victory. And we had predicted that the Republicans would win the Senate and that Donald Trump would win between 278 votes and 296 electoral votes. And I have to tell you, I think President Trump's ground game the last 2 weeks were very, very strong. I think President Trump kept on message. He discussed the economy. And I think with current world events with regard to instability in Russia, you have the Arab-Israeli issue going on with regard to the Palestinians. I think there was a lot of uncertainty. And I think people felt that President Trump demonstrated greater leadership. So I think at the end of the day, aside from economic issues, I think the issue of just leadership. If you look today, you look in Germany, there's issues in Germany. But I think today, the ability to broadcast and demonstrate leadership is a critical factor. So I think the election in the United States is a real strong message to other leaders in the world that leadership really counts.
So what are your expectations of the incoming administration before you go, Joe? What are your expectations of the incoming administration?
Well, as you know, I'm down here in Mar-a-Lago with the president and his team. I would say this much. You know, I think when President Trump was elected as 45th president, they had a slow start. I mean, obviously, President Trump was not very active and involved with, the political process. But I think what you will see on January 20th, you will see a full cabinet in place. Because the Republicans have the Senate now, I think you're going to see in the next few weeks President Trump nominating all of his cabinet, which means on January 20th, the Trump administration will be close to being fully appointed and running the government. Where if you look at Trump's first term as president, I think the first 6 months were rather difficult in getting cabinet members appointed. So I think you'll see the president quickly move on appointing the cabinet, and I think his priority will be economics in terms of the United States. And I think he'll look at national security issues thereafter. But I think his priority will be looking at jobs, the economy, and seeing how he can kind of stimulate the economy a little further.
Joseph Slavik is the founder of Scribe Strategies and Advisors, which now counts business, government, and nonprofit clients on four continents. He spoke with me from Mar-a-Lago, Florida. U.S. President Joe Biden has promised a smooth and peaceful transition on January 20. This is when President-elect Donald Trump will be officially sworn into office. It comes as former President Trump defeated incumbent Vice President Kamala Harris in the just-concluded U.S. presidential contest. Meanwhile, experts say new leadership creates a disruption and can change culture for better or for worse. For more information on what to expect regarding the transition process and its impact, I reach Britt Hoag. She is the founder of The Collective Good, strategy firm that helps leaders drive social change and has over 20 years of experience working across the social, public, and private sectors.
You know, I'm really glad that President Biden and Vice President Harris are leading with this commitment to a smooth transition. What we really want, I think, as a country, is to know that our leaders are leading with what's best for us as a community, which is a smooth transition of leadership. We know transitions can be hard. They can be hard in our daily lives within the companies in which we work, within our personal lives, and certainly at this level, the ultimate level of a presidential and administrative shift, folks are going to be trying to kind of wrap their arms around kind of what was and now what will be.
Talking about change, experts such as yourself usually say that people are often resistant to change. How can leaders handle this?
Well, change is hard, and changes are disruptive. You're being asked to do something new or to embrace something new. And we, again, in our personal lives, change is hard. In our workplaces, in politics, change is hard. And so I think what leaders, can do to help folks through that change is first to acknowledge it and to just say out loud, I know change is hard, and I want to give some space for that. It's to listen to folks because, people will resist change for different reasons. So if you take a moment to really understand what is it exactly that folks are resisting so that you can address those specific things, right? So just taking a moment to get under the resistance as opposed to, trying to just move people past it. And kind of ask them to button up their feelings and move on. You don't have to give a, you know, spend months talking about it, but if you give a little bit of space to just hear where folks are coming from, meet them again where they are, and then use that to move forward, I have found that the level of resistance comes down. Folks understand that you're here to not to be disruptive, but that you have a job to do, and that you're interested in doing it with the community, as opposed to you know, driving folks into a new direction. You want to go with, as opposed to directive.
In politics and in business and elsewhere, leaders or new leaders that come in usually are given what most people say is the honeymoon phase or honeymoon period. Why does this matter?
Yeah, well, so in organizations, the honeymoon period is usually, you know, those first couple of months, 4 to 6 months, you've got to get in, figure things out, and start to show folks that you have a plan, right? That you've moved on from the listening, and that you're taking some action. In the political arena, usually we refer to the first 100 days in office, right? You have those 100 days where you've got to figure things out, listen to folks, come up with a plan, start talking about your vision, sharing a vision. And it's tricky because you're a new leader, and so you're spinning a lot of plates, right? You're trying to create that space. You're trying to listen. You're trying to vision. You're trying to action plan. And so to come into that really intentionally as a leader is quite important, because once that period is up, folks, you know, have moved on. You know, they either you show them that you are here to do something, you know, to be effective. You're going to respond to whatever issue was going on before you arrived. Here's how you're going to address it. Here's how you're going to fix the problem. And you really only have people's attention for a short period of time where they're looking for answers. They're looking to be engaged. And so that's usually what we're talking about when we refer to the honeymoon phase.
Brad Hogue is the founder of the Collective Good strategy firm that helps leaders drive social change. She spoke with me from New York. Huldah Hitzley has made history in the Midwestern U.S. state of Minnesota, becoming the only person born in Kenya to win election to the State House of Representatives. Hitzley, who is a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, will represent a constituency northwest of the main city of Minneapolis. Her family came to the United States when she was a child. My colleague Abdu Shakur Abud with VOA Swahili Service interviewed her shortly after the election. Here's part of the conversation.
During our talk, we have been talking is that the immigrants here in America, especially from Africa, you have a challenge. They don't come together to bring and help. You didn't get that. Give us some more word. What do you think about that? What's to be done?
So I think the biggest challenge that for our immigrant community is that we come here and we settle, right? We think that we have arrived. And also, you know, I don't blame our community. It's a lack of knowledge, not understanding and knowing how this system works, not knowing, you know, what the value of this system and what that can bring into their lives. And so I sit here and I take that mantle, right, to educate our community and say, hey, you know, there's also power when we get our people at the table, right? When we get our people to talk about, you know, this is what's important to us. And because that's the whole essence of politics, right? And being a leader in that space, making sure that you're fighting for the voices of those people who might not know what's possible. And the fact that I had a little taste of what's possible and the resources that are out here, it is my job to go back to my community and tell them, hey, there are resources here. This is how this system works. Let's work together to mobilize and make sure that we are also taking a piece of the pie.
So what are you going to do for your community, for Minnesota, as the first woman, Black African from Africa, from Kenya?
From Kenya. Well, that is an honor that I don't take lightly, as being the first Kenyan born, right? A lot of people have been like, well, I don't know if she's the first Kenyan, because we had Obama, right? That was the historical. As a woman, you're right. I'm the first woman. You're right. I am the first woman. And that carries a lot of, you know, responsibilities. And I don't want to be the last. Like Kamala always says, you know, I'm going to be the first, but I'm not going to be the last. And I'm hoping that this moment right here is a testimony that, you know, you can come to this country, work hard, take care of business, know your craft, stick to it, be consistent, and get to where you want to be.
I know it's too early.
Yes.
Have you an agenda? What are your first? You know,
my agenda. Yes, yes, yes. So I'm excited about championing a couple of things. My constituency, obviously, you know, the people who elected me, Senate District 38A, that is Brooklyn Park and Osseo, you know, they're worried about public safety. So I want to champion policies that really promote a community-centered public safety policies. I want to champion options, housing options, and making sure that our renters are protected. Rights. I want to champion workers' rights, where we have strong unions that are really supporting the community and making sure that we do have, you know, our livable wages. We do have, you know, protected workforce. And of course, small businesses. You know, we want to make sure that Senate District 38A or Senate District 38 in general, you know, has a thriving and robust business, small business economy. Right now, you know, the small businesses in my district are ran by immigrants, right? African immigrants. So I'm super excited to come in and look at what's possible and then go back to my community and say, hey, this is the resources that are out there that are going to help you keep being consistent and also grow your businesses. So I'm definitely looking forward to championing small businesses.
So what message do you have? How to tell the other colleagues? There were a lot of Africans who did not succeed. Your campaign reached the climax. What
yes.
message do you have to them for the next time or what to do?
My message is simple. Be consistent. You know, I commit to this space. I ran for Senate the last election cycle. We put in a great fight. We lost, but I take that loss as a learning opportunity, right? So I took all the lessons that I learned from the Senate race and brought it to the House race. And one of the biggest lessons that I learned is utilizing data, right? And so this time around, we definitely made decisions and we tweaked our strategic plan based on the data. And so I want to tell our people, keep going. I know that my brother Sam Wangi lost just by a few, I think it was like 46 votes, right? And I look back and I go, you are that close and this is your first time running. My brother, keep going. So I want to encourage our people. We need more of us to run. There's enough space in this legislature for more people of color, especially immigrants, because that's the voice that is missing.
That was Helda Hilsley, an immigrant from Kenya, who this week was elected to the Minnesota State Legislature. She spoke with VOA's Abdul Shakur Aboud. In South Sudan, peace talks are scheduled to soon begin following a meeting between President Salva Kiir and Kenyan President William Ruto. The Tumaini Peace Initiative, which started in May, aimed to provide a foundation for the inclusion of non-signatory groups to sustain peace in South Sudan. But local media reports say the talks stalled after Riek Machar's party withdrew, sharply disagreeing with what it says were plans by mediators to replace the 2018 peace agreement. The accord effectively ended the country's civil war. Pagam Amum, the leader of the Real Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or Real SPLM, and a team leader in the Tumaini Peace Initiative dialogue in Nairobi, disagrees with the resumption of the dialogue, which the administration in Juba supports. He tells me that all that is left is for the full implementation of the Tumaini talks recently concluded in Kenya.
President Ruto, before he went to Juba, he visited Juba, we met him and discussed with him the way forward for the Tumaini Peace Initiative. We have communicated to him that we have negotiated with the government and finalized the Tumaini, and we, as the opposition, have been waiting for the government to return to the talks, to return to Nairobi, and to proceed to sign the Tumaini consensus. There is no more negotiations. There are no any outstanding issues. And we are just left with the signing. And actually, President Kiir agreed with President Ruto that the government would come on the 16th of September last month, or 2 months ago, to come and sign the Tumaini. Unfortunately, the government did not come. They developed cold feet, and or they have a change of mind to sign what they have negotiated.
So the question is, what is the drawback? What is holding back the talks from moving forward from where it is?
I think the government has no interest to achieve a real sustainable peace in South Sudan.
Why do you say that?
I say that because we have negotiated, we have finalized with the government all the issues of the Tumaini, the entire agenda. We have negotiated them, with exception of one which is also left for them to decide.
Where do the people of South Sudan go from here? Because there's on again, off again peace talks. Several peace talks have been had. The peace has yet to return to South Sudan. Where do the people of South Sudan go from here?
I think it is for the people of South Sudan to really intensify their struggle for peace and transition to democracy.
For those who participated in these peace talks, now that the government of President Salva Kiir is talking about reviving the peace talks, what are your hopes for the anticipated revival of the peace talks?
There is nothing to be revived. The Tumaini consensus has been negotiated and agreed by the parties. What is left is for signing. Let the government come and sign so that we go and implement the peace agreement that we have negotiated. That's all what is needed. That's what the people of South Sudan is expecting from them.
Where are we now in the process? Because, as you said, things appear not to be as smooth. What are the underlying factors that is
actually
undermining everything?
Everything is smooth. What is to be done for the government to return to Nairobi and sign the Tumaini consensus which they have negotiated with the opposition? That's all what is left. They should muster the courage and remain committed to what they have negotiated and agreed to. The people of South Sudan want peace. The people of South Sudan want to end these failed transitions that this government has been taking the country endlessly through all sufferings. What is left is simple. Come and sign. Don't reopen. Don't take the process back. Don't delay peace. Simple.
Pagam Amum is the leader of the Real Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or Real SPLM, and a team leader in the Tumaini Peace Initiative dialogue. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Uganda, a recent scuffle between two lawmakers in parliament is generating debate about the behavior of lawmakers in the legislative body, thus following a fight between Anthony Akol from the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, FDC, and Francis Zake, a member of the National Unity Platform, or NUP. Local media reports say Zake was punched in the face several times by Akol following a disagreement over a seat. Zake was subsequently taken to the hospital where he is receiving medical care. Critics of the opposition say the fight appears to be staged to thwart the government-backed but controversial National Kofi Amendment Bill. For analysis of the latest political development, I reach Gerald Walulia. He is a lecturer in the Department of Journalism and Communication at the Makerere University in Uganda.
The behavior and conduct of parliament, especially in this term, has been very suspect in so many ways. We have noted that parliament is no longer led by arguments as it's supposed to be, but there are a lot of underhand activities that are going on And this is the part of the reason why we get such scaffolds. One of the thoughts we had when we saw this scaffold is that this seemed to be a pre-planned event, probably as a way of making sure that opposition and members and those members who were opposed to the proposal to scrap the organization in charge of promoting coffee farming.
But some people are rejecting it from the opposition party that it was not pre-planned. If somebody was attacked in parliament, a member of parliament was attacked, it should be investigated and probably dealt with in parliament rather than people perceive it to be a planned act to frustrate a parliamentary measure about coffee.
Whereas the Speaker of Parliament suspended some members in relation to this scaffold and other events which followed later, we are aware that Parliament might not be interested in pursuing this because most of the people who were affected in the scaffold are generally opposition-leaning people. And Parliament is generally tilted in favor of the ruling party. If, for instance, the person who was boxed in Parliament was a member of the ruling party, I think the reaction from Parliament might have been different. And I'm sure such issues might have taken the interest of Parliament. But we don't see that this might be the case.
Does that mean that there is an unequal treatment when it comes to the opposition in this case?
It is not a secret that the way the current administration of parliament manages parliament is very much biased against the opposition. That's why the security forces are able to be invited in parliament to arrest opposition members of parliament. As long as things go the government way, the leadership of parliament is not bothered. So the parliament we have in Uganda acts as if it is another arm of the ruling party.
I understand a lot of Ugandans have expressed concern. The mandate of parliament itself has been undermined by the invitation of security agents or security forces into parliament due to separation of powers. Your take?
In Uganda, the principle of separation of powers is currently not working because the executive has literally swallowed up all the other arms of government, and whatever the president wants is what happens, whether in judiciary or in parliament. So there is certainly no separation of powers. So everything goes as wanted by the president or the executive.
Does that mean that due to the overwhelming dominance of the NRM in parliament, that is what partly accounts for what you just described?
That is partly the reason, but also the other reason relates to the nature and character of our president, who is generally a domineering character who does not take any kind of compromise from any other parties that might be involved in any given issue. So whereas we talk about the executive, in reality we are talking about the president. It is the president who calls the shots on every issue, and everything must go according to his will.
Gerald Walulia is a lecturer in the Department of Journalism and Communication at the Makerere University. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, President Paul Biya has marked 42 years since taking over as the leader of the Central African country. Biya, who was prime minister in 1982, was handed over power by the first president of Cameroon, Amadou Ahidjo. But as supporters of the governing Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, marked the 42nd anniversary of the president's achievements with celebration and encouragement, his opponents are expressing disappointment. They contend that many more people have been impoverished by policies the president had implemented over the years. They are now calling for a change in leadership. For more reaction to the celebration and opposition criticism, I reach Professor Elvis Ngole. He is the coordinator of academia for the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM.
The whole nation has celebrated 42 years of visionary leadership, which has been characterized by tremendous achievements. Tremendous achievements amongst which are the liberalization of the country, liberalization of the economy, of politics, modernization of a lot of infrastructure, and diplomatic expansion. And all these facts, which are there for everyone to see, make us, as a matter of faith and as a matter of affection and love, to say that it's worth celebrating the 42 years of such tremendous transformation, such tremendous change. Of course, in all celebrations, we also reflect. We reflect on the challenges that we have gone through and work that needs to be done.
Some of his critics are saying that the 42 years has become stale, and that there are no new ideas that he is implementing, and that Cameroon, unlike other African countries, it should have been developed with the natural resources and youthful manpower that Cameroon has. They should be way ahead than where Cameroon is now. Your response to that?
Those criticisms are nothing new. But again, those criticisms have their place in society. That is one of the expectations of liberalization. In all honesty, in all good faith, we have to first appreciate the fact that the liberalization and the modernization of the society has enabled us to recognize our creative capacities, our creative energies. And because of that discovery, Cameroonians are so creative now, and Cameroonians now crave and desire to go to heaven, I think, or to go to the skies or to the moon. That's already good. But for us to say that because some things are yet to be done, or that we could have done better, therefore nothing was done, or therefore what has been done is bad, I think that's why I say that is not correct, because that would amount to bad faith or some sort of dishonesty. Now, we appreciate that a lot has been done tremendously, but of course we recognize that we still have a lot of work to do.
What do you say to those who are saying that for the CPDM to keep on presenting a 90-year-plus man as leader of a youthful Cameroon is a disrespect to the people, that Cameroonians want a change, at least to improve their living conditions economically?
The first thing I would like to tell you in response to that is that we respect age. We respect our elders, and because we know that age goes with wisdom, age goes with experience, and age goes with a certain sense of dignity and integrity. So for us, in our tradition and in our religion, we respect that. Secondly, in terms of our constitution, and you know, we are a constitutional republic. Our constitution does not, and even in terms of democratic principles and values, the maximum age is not an issue. So I think that for one to make that case that because of age, this could have been done or this has not been done, is almost tantamount to saying that age is a factor of performance. I don't think age is a factor of management. But for us, no law is broken by age. The constitution is not violated by age. And in our republic, which is a constitutional republic, we allow for he or she who has the capacity and the ability, who is loved by the people, to do their job.
Professor Elvis Ngole is the coordinator of academia for the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. In Zambia, the spokesperson for the opposition coalition group called the Tonse Alliance has chosen former President Edgar Chagwa Lungu as presidential candidate in the coming 2026 general election. Sean Tembo says the former president has the best electoral chance to defeat incumbent President Hakainde Hichilema in the presidential contest. His comments came after the recent launch of the opposition Tonse Alliance. Members of the group include the Patriots for Economic Progress, the Patriotic Front, the Christian Democratic Party, the Zambia Republican Party, the New Era Democratic Party, the New Congress Party, Umozi Kumwa, and the Center for Constitutionalism and Legal Justice. Sean Tembo tells me that it was important for like-minded people and groups to come together to wrestle power from the administration in the coming vote.
So, from our standpoint, we believe that the candidate who has the highest probability of beating the incumbent president, Hakainde Hichilema, is the 60th Republican president, Dr. Edgar Chagwa Lungu. So, given the fact that we don't want to take any chances, the only and the most definite candidate that we could adopt was Dr. Edgar Chagwa Lungu himself, the 60th Republican president. The other reason is the fact that when you look at the presidency of Dr. Edgar Chagwa Lungu, he delivered on the majority of his promises. And economically, the country was doing reasonably well. Even when you look at the issues of rule of law and governance, we were doing reasonably well compared to where we are today. And there's this cry, this never-ending cry by the Zambian people for change of leadership at the helm.
John, there are reports that the former president is in court. A decision will be made by a court on December 10th whether he will be eligible to stand or not. Did you take that into consideration?
Of course we did. But when you look at the merits of that case, you will realize that that is a case that is not new in terms of it being before the courts of law. It is a case that has been taken to court on numerous other occasions, precisely six other occasions. And on each of those six occasions, the court have ruled that President Edgar Chagwa Lungu was eligible to stand in the 2021 presidential elections. So we don't expect the Constitutional Court to depart from its own decisions in the six previous occasions. We don't expect that. We know that as things stand today, the judiciary in Zambia has largely been compromised. We are cognizant of that fact. But we believe that the judiciary has not been compromised to the extent that it would go against the decisions that it has made on six other occasions within the past four-year period or so. We don't think they would sink that low. If they did, well, that would be a new face. But we don't expect them to sink that low.
Now, from your statement... if in the unlikely event that a constitutional court reverses its stance and say that the former president is not eligible, then what happens to the Tonse Alliance?
Well, we'll cross that bridge when we reach it. We can't cross it before we reach it.
But with all intents and purposes, Zambians overwhelmingly voted against him in the previous elections, and people are saying that with the power of incumbency and the resources of the state, the UPND and by extension President Hakainde Hichilema will be difficult to defeat.
Well, you mean the way the American people had overwhelmingly voted against President Trump in 2020? And then decided to re-elect him in 2024. The way the Brazilian people had voted against President De Silva and then decided to re-elect him. Or the way the Mexican people had previously voted against their president and then decided to re-elect him. The bottom line is that the fact that someone loses an election doesn't mean that is the final verdict in the minds of the electorate. When they experience even worse leadership, they'll always miss what they have, however little it might have been. And that is exactly what has happened in Zambia. The Zambian people miss President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. They miss him to be at the helm of this country. And they miss the progressive economic policies he implemented. They, of course, miss a lot of other aspects. Not to say that he did not make mistakes when he was head of state. Of course, like any other human being, he did make some mistakes. But we have no doubt in our minds that he has since learned from those mistakes that he might have made while in office, and that when the Zambian people, I don't want to say if, but when the Zambian people re-elect him in 2026, then he will come back as a much better and a more refined leader with the wisdom of having previously presided over the affairs of this country, something that cannot be said about most of the other aspiring potential leaders in this country at the moment.
Sean Tembo is the spokesperson for the opposition coalition group called the Tonse Alliance. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Chadian President Mahamat Idriss Deby says scores of Boko Haram fighters were killed and several dozen injured in airstrikes his military launched against the terrorist group in the Lake Chad Basin Friday. Chad began an operation against the Islamic militant group after Boko Haram fighters killed 40 Chadian soldiers in an attack on a military garrison last month. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
About 700 Chadian soldiers celebrated Friday as troops of the Central African States Air Force returned to Kaiga Kindira, an island in the Lake Chad Basin near the border with Nigeria. Among top military officials present to welcome the troops was Chad's President Mahamat Idriss Deby.
Nous avons lancé l'opération Askari.
Deby says his troops are happy because Haskinight, an operation he launched to search out and eliminate Boko Haram members hiding in the Lake Chad Basin, has begun successfully with the killing of scores of fighters in several hideouts. Deby also says several dozen militants were injured in air strikes carried out by Chad's military in the Lake region Thursday night into Friday. Chad's military says the air attacks targeted 5 Boko Haram hideouts but did not identify locations. Deby said, besides deploying the Air Force, he has ordered close to 1,000 infantry and navy troops to eliminate Boko Haram fighters and protect civilians who are constantly harassed, raped, maimed, and killed by militants in the Lake Chad area. The military says soldiers have seized many weapons and destroyed boats used by Boko Haram fighters to attack civilians and government troops. Deby said the attacks on Boko Haram will continue until the Islamist militant group is eradicated and people in the area can live peacefully. Deby, who spoke on Chad State TV Friday, has been in areas of the Lake Chad Basin shared by Cameroon, Nigeria, Niger, and Chad since October 28, when Boko Haram fighters attacked a military garrison and killed 40 Chadian soldiers. Chad's military says scores of Chadian soldiers were injured in the attack on the island of Bakaram near the border with Nigeria. Chad's government called on its citizens to support the ongoing operation by reporting all strangers in their towns and villages to soldiers, government officials, and traditional rulers. Pascal Kanabe Marcelin is Chad's water and sanitation minister. He told officials of the Lake Chad Basin Commission meeting in N'Djamena Friday that he is very happy because villagers in Lake Chad who live in fear of Boko Haram are assisting government troops.
Nous devons sérieusement et sincèrement conjuguer nos efforts.
He says Deby wants all countries of the Lake Chad Basin Commission to assist Chad troops fighting Boko Haram by allowing soldiers to cross over to Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger in hot pursuit of the militants. He says he is grateful to civilians who have been contributing food and money to assist troops fighting Boko Haram in Lake Chad. Chad government officials say people of goodwill have been donating rice, cows, groundnuts, water, and first aid equipment to troops fighting the terror group. Boko Haram launched an insurgency against the Nigerian government in 2009. Fighting spread into Cameroon, Chad and Niger, where the militants established bases and hideouts. The UN says the fighting has killed more than 40,000 people and displaced over 3 million. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
Baby, one, oh, you're one, baby, come you want to see a little chocoba mama. I saw one baby, you shake your two, drop it down, baby. You shake your two, show me you want to see a little chocoba mama. Yeah, Benz in the shade, Benz in the Avita. To combine it, but then you see the air to your land. Eh, aga, no phone yesterday, give it to your kupita. Hasa visi kuchanganyo, kanishusha thamani. Penzi langu sicheze kachura, iwe dance.
Iwe dance.
Kanifanya mchepu the ruler, images.
Images.
Oh, Marina, moyo wangu mwenzako mi mwepesi.
Mi mwepesi.
Isiche kufu, kwa mapresha ufungwe. Asa usitishwe naye
mbele
oh anapiga eti kujifanya
vierere
kwa sisi hawatawezi oh baby
mbele mbele
ale tantarira
kelelele
mnoknoko baby
vierere
kwa sisi hawatawezi
and I want them to know
oh yeah hey, you're the one I love one and only the one I wanna know. I want them to know,
baby, hey, oh, you're the one I love.
I'm open as I
know. Hey, the one I want to.
I saw one baby, why for your one baby? Drop it down, baby. Show me you want to see a little chocoba mama. I saw one baby,
you should get to it.
Drop it down, baby.
You should get to it.
Show me you want to see. Ali chokupa mama, openzi letu moto,
moto,
moto, moto, baby,
moto,
lina wanguza,
moto,
moto, moto,
moto,
I say baby white a fire,
moto,
na wachoma buba,
moto,
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 moto.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga and engineer the great Tiang Wang. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you don't want to sleep because you don't want to die, you will die because you don't sleep. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Na shikunga na miyonde si mama le na miyonde.